I'm Patrick Martins.
And I'm Shauna Pacifico.
And this is The Main Course. We like to say if it's Sunday, it's The Main Course.
It's Sunday, The Main Course.
Meet the Press, it kind of uses that.
Oh, yeah?
But not to as much fanfare.
But not at all, I don't think. How many listeners do you think we have?
Our stock answer is a million.
It's
probably closer to like 100 live listeners.
Okay, that's
but
not
then,
bad.
But then, because we built the site as an archive, you know, we get like thousands and thousands of hits a week, people downloading. And now we have MP3s. We have downloadable stuff.
Oh, you do? That's
yes.
News.
There's a beautiful little logo next to each program, and you can pick any show and listen to it on your iPhone.
There you go. Oh, it's about time.
It's amazing.
Moving
these
on up.
These young kids, they know so much. Well, we have a very exciting show. Today, we are brought to you by one of the greatest, most powerful businesses in the world.
Oh, really?
Saxelby Cheesemongers.
Evil power business.
No, they help people.
No, Saxelby. I buy my cheese from Saxelby.
What cheeses do you have on the menu right now from Saxelby Cheese Shop?
I have a square goat cheese on the menu. It's from Twig Hill, Vermont.
Okay.
It's really good. And then I also do, what else is there? Oh, there's the small mini burratas, which is like the mozzarella pouch stuffed with creamy, soft mozzarella, creamy goodness.
But there's no mozzarella di bufala in America, like made in America on any real scale, huh?
I don't know the answer to that.
It's like a national cheese of Italy.
But this is fresh made mozzarella. I don't know if it's di bufala, but
okay,
it's definitely cow.
Cow, that's like.
But it's
buffalo.
Really good. And then we get a goat feta.
Oh.
From her. So
for your Greek salad.
Yes, when she has to deliver cheese, she needs to get a car to deliver it because I have to order so much.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So anyway, we're brought to you by Saxelby Cheesemongers, which is located at the Essex Street Market. And what else? We have a pretty cool show. We're going to be talking with the gentleman from the River Project. We're going to have JT and Chris on to talk more about, I guess, fish. In the Hudson. I didn't
fish
think
the
they
Hudson.
Lived they, in the Hudson.
Yes, and maybe talk about the pollution of the Hudson. And my question is it still safe to swim in there? I know that people do swim in there, but
maybe we can
scary.
Ask them. You can ask them if that's how they catch all their fish,
they
just by
swimming
in there and grabbing them. So we also are going to have Jacques at Palo, from the chef and owner of Palo Santo, one of Park Slope's and Brooklyn's best restaurants.
It's very good.
If not the best, as he would say.
I had the best black beans and eggs.
Oh.
It was really good.
He's a very interesting sourcer. I want to talk to him about sourcing.
Okay.
So we're going to take a break, but I mean, we should mention, and this is going to be talked a lot more about the Q report, but Senator Ted Kennedy passed away this week. And I thought it was appropriate to mention on the main course because he founded Meals on Wheels.
Oh, really?
Just
I
like
didn't know that.
Every chef is
has done something with it. Yeah.
Yeah, so that's a way he's really affected food. And I love what he wrote. Said, "I am part of all whom I've met."
Huh. And sounds like a wise man.
He really is, but he seemed like that. You know, some people are born wealthy and to power, and they are about keeping it or just following what they know. And here was a guy who, you know, really tried to rise poor people, you know, from their bad destiny. So we honor him on the main course.
Yes, we do.
And what else should we talk about
right now
they
or
said
later?
He was a Rabelaisian figure.
A what?
Rabelais was that medieval cartoonist who was like he wrote about Gargantua and all these like weird carnivalesque drinking, you know. Anyway, Kennedy was kind of a Rabelaisian figure. Which has to do with carnival, but
oh,
we won't
we
make that. They did call him a Rabelaisian figure.
I know you want to ask me. Go ahead.
So were you like in the carnival and stuff?
I did grow up in the carnival business. I am a carny kid.
Oh,
yes.
My God.
Traveling around selling. My parents sold food at fairs anywhere from the Midwest to the East Coast.
Wow. Did you use this? Did you hear this a lot? The old carny side muscle?
No.
So what kinds of food did they prepare?
We did what you call elephant ears, fried dough, which is known here in the New York area, Zeppelis.
Zeppelis,
but they're flattened out. It's basically like a fried flatbread with butter and cinnamon sugar on top. And then, well, actually, my whole entire family does it. My uncle, he has a whole line of Italian sausages and London broils and steak sandwiches and corn dogs. And my sister does cinnamon rolls. My brother does fried vegetables. Yes, I come from a line of carny folks.
Carny folks and carny food, which actually sounds very delicious. So you moved down, actually, when you became head chef of Back 40.
I'm the only one that got away, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I left town a while ago and haven't been back since, but I do still miss it sometimes.
What were your favorite or most striking carny character that you had met over the years?
Well, that's kind of a misconception.
Oh, yeah?
In a sense. Like, they're just regular people. They just live a different lifestyle.
I mean, was one guy particularly tall or strong? Or?
No, it's not. Like, it's not a freak show. It's just a business. A big business that a lot of people do independently.
Okay. Sorry, I mean, you know, I just have this romantic vision of running away with the circus, like I think every kid has, and you kind of grew up
in it. But it's not a circus.
It.
It's different.
Oh, okay.
It's different. There's circuses,
more like games and stuff.
Yeah, games and rides, and I mean, it's a huge multi-million-dollar business.
If the games were unfair and rigged against the consumer, would you speak out?
They aren't rigged. They're just hard to win. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're made for you not to win. I mean, it's not like,
right.
But there's actually, I think there's like some kind of law. If it's really, really made for you not to win at all, then they can't be on. They can't use it.
And where was this? State of Florida?
No, I'm from Florida, but we traveled all around the U.S.
Unbelievable. You should be a guest, a full hour on your travels.
On my carnival business?
Have you ever written a book or journals?
No, but there's a thought in the back of my head to write about it.
It's an exciting life. Well,
it's interesting.
We are going to take our 30-second break and come back with JT and Chris Anderson and talking about our river. It's Sunday. This is the main course. I'm Patrick Martins.
I'm Shauna Pacifico.
And it's a beautiful day at Roberta's. For people who have not been to Roberta's, they should come. It's absolutely delicious food. And there's a radio studio built out of two shipping containers in the back.
And pictures of mimosas, which make me very happy.
My God, poor Francis at the bar is going to be ticked. That took him like 1 hour to make that picture.
Oh, it did not.
We have some very interesting guests. We actually have Jacques from Palo Santo. He's going to be... guys, you know we can hear music in our ears, right? Okay, just making sure. We're produced by... Semi-produced. No, just kidding. We're produced by Jack Inslee and engineered by Nat Wiener. Jack Inslee is also known as Rec Tech. We have Jacques from Palo Santo, who's going to be coming in a little later, but you might be hearing his voice. And right now, we're going to talk to J.T. Baim and Chris Anderson, who are prominent figures in New York's River Project. Welcome.
Thank you.
How you doing?
What is the River Project?
Well, it's a marine science field station at Pier 40 in Manhattan, and we concentrate on educating the public on a lot of the issues that face the Hudson River and We like to let people know that there's a lot of life living beneath the surface and give them ways to conserve it so we have them in the future.
What are some of the ways that you are educating the public? What are some of the programs you're offering?
Well, I'm the educator, so I do all of those types of programs. We do a lot of field trips, so we'll have students anywhere from 5, 6 years old, young kids, all the way through college and through grad school. We have a lot of NYU students that come and do a lot of work with us. So we like to bring students to the river, get them close to the water, and we do a lot of different activities. We do a lot of fish trapping, and we discuss a lot of conservation efforts going on across the Hudson River. And we really focus on the Hudson River estuary, which is the mixture of salt and fresh water from the Atlantic Ocean up about, I guess, 65 miles probably from Manhattan up to Newburgh, and then all the way beyond up to Troy, New York, which is about 150 miles. So there's tidal influence, which means that the tides rise and fall twice a day, all the way up to the dam in Troy, New York. So it's
so
a very interesting...
So Troy to Newburgh, it's that little pocket where the most interesting stuff is happening in the river?
Well, actually, Newburgh is about where the salt usually goes up to from the Atlantic Ocean. So that's quite a, it's quite a long ways.
Oh, that's far.
Yeah, so...
The Hudson's tidal all the way up till Troy,
which means
about half the river.
Right, which means that it rises and falls just like the ocean does, twice a day.
And that's unusual for a river to have tides.
Yeah, I mean, you wouldn't normally think of it like that. It has to be an estuary. It has to be connected to an ocean to be able to do that. Otherwise, inland rivers are obviously not going to do that.
So the ocean ends up, even though the river flows out, there's still obviously an effect going both ways.
Exactly.
In terms of tide and...
It doesn't always flow out. It flows. Sometimes it goes north. Sometimes it goes south.
Is that true? I mean, which direction does? I mean, the Nile flows north, right? And the Hudson.
Yeah. The river flows back and forth essentially with the tides, but the fresh water is flowing out towards the ocean. Ocean water is coming in, and so depending on the tidal pull, the water's going sort of moving back and forth and going towards the ocean.
Very interesting.
Wow.
And so that, you know, that's one thing that makes the estuary so productive, is because you have nutrients coming down from the mountains and the watershed, and then also things moving into the estuary from the ocean. So you have like a mixing effect, which creates a lot of productivity for. So traditionally, estuaries are some of the most productive places in the ocean, or in most productive aquatic ecosystems in the world for fish production and, you know, overall.
It's also the crossroads of salmon, right? I mean, not here, but I mean, that estuaries are where salmon are able to make that run between salt and freshwater, right?
Yeah, and we actually have our own type of salmon or fish that are born in freshwater and then they live their life in the ocean. So they're, and then they come back, and we actually, like striped bass are similar type fish. So they're born in freshwater, then they go out, live most of their life in the ocean, and then come back to spawn in the Hudson. So there's millions of striped bass in our area.
And like the salmon, do they return back to the exact spot in which they were born?
I don't know if that's really known exactly or not. I mean, there's probably been tagging projects that have been done, but yeah, I mean, definitely within the same area, so they all come back into the estuary or even go farther upstate into more fresh water to spawn and then return back to the sea for most of their lives.
How polluted is the Hudson River still?
It's getting a lot better. I'd say
that doesn't sound good.
Well, it's I want to be optimistic, and we all
it's
are
relatively polluted,
but. Yeah, I mean it's still in trouble, and that's one of the main reasons we are trying to educate people about it and get people close to it to get some more interaction to be able to want to conserve it. And since the Clean Water Act of 1972, it's steadily improved, and wastewater from businesses and factories, that's much more regulated now. So in the last 30 years, I'd say it's really, really drastically improved. But
is it safe? Is it safe? I mean,
well, one of the Yeah, one of the things that makes it, that, you know, creates an issue with eating fish from the river, and are a lot of the industrial pollutants from back in, you know, the day are still there. So they don't, PCBs and other thing, dioxins and things that have just been trapped down in the sediment prior to the Clean Water Act are still around and will be for a long time unless they're dredged out or kind of washed out of the system. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the things that kind of makes the harbor and the Hudson.
So how do you test it? So you do passive trapping, you were saying, which you basically throw traps down and passively catch whatever you get, and then you test them for, you use them for research.
Well, why do you catch the fish? I mean, that's really interesting. And also how you trap them, and then like what studies do you do with them?
Yeah, well, we have been doing sort of a biodiversity assessment since 1986. We've been collecting fish and invertebrates, also crabs, shrimp, lots of different snails, all sorts of different creatures that live there. But we collect all these different things and kind of monitor trends in populations. So we get to see how well certain species, a group of species, are doing. And if they're, if we see populations going up one year, that might tell us that it might be a good indicator that the health of the harbor, the health of the river, is improving. Or if we see less of a species, at a certain time of the year or a certain year, then we might know that there has maybe been like an outflow of toxins from some industrial area or something like that. But yeah, all these species are good to constantly monitor to be able to be an indicator for the health of the area.
How can you you catch one fish? I mean, how do you monitor populations? I understand that you can catch one of something, but do you have underground technology, or I mean, how do you know how the fish are running as a group?
Well, doing continuous trapping year week after week and year after year kind of also gives us an idea of when the fish come into and use the estuary. So it also teaches us about the life cycle of the fish. So when we pull up, when we do the trapping, we just over time, you'll see trends depending on how much the conditions of the water and the season, which fish like to be in the area where we are, which is the lower Hudson and the estuary, at what time periods.
Well, I have a list here of some fish that you guys have trapped over the years. Let's talk about a couple of them. We have American eel, oyster toadfish, lined seahorse, and obviously striped bass. What's so special about?
What about the snapper?
Yeah,
well, that's a Chef Jacques being like, "There's snapper right here. Do you know how cheap that would be with no transportation?"
They're more in the marine area, the snapper, but they are around New York.
Do they get lost? Is my question.
But yeah, I mean, all
we're
of those
set
fish
up a foghorn now.
Oh no, wait,
that's a weird foghorn.
Yeah,
hold on. This is the Jacques gonna do a lookout for snapper. Hold on. Sorry.
Yeah, all those fish that you mentioned are pretty common in our area, and they all have interesting life histories and different things about them. Like the American eel, you talk about the salmon, which is known to spawn in freshwater and then migrate out and live its life in the ocean. The American eel is actually the opposite. So they are almost all the American eels are believed to breed in the Sargassum Sea in the middle of the ocean. They breed there, and then they, as juveniles, get swept up into rivers, and they'll actually, like the Hudson, then they live for 25, 30 years up in the freshwater, and then all of the eels, when they reach maturity, they migrate thousands of miles back to the Sargassum Sea.
25, 30 years?
Live a long time.
But where's the Sargassum Sea? I thought I knew all the oceans and seas.
It's sort of out there in the middle of the ocean.
It's just a part of the Atlantic?
Yeah, yeah. And that's where...
What makes it its own... What would you call that, a watershed?
Yeah, I'm not too sure.
What is a watershed exactly? I mean, people hear that all the time. I mean, is it just an... a terroir of water?
Well, I mean, a watershed is generally a river system, including all of its tributaries. And in our case, we have the Hudson River, which is tidal. So it influences lots of different rivers and tributaries mm-hmm. that are connected to it. And so the Hudson River being a major body of water, it really affects a lot of environments around it. And with it being tidal, it means that also some streams around it are tidal. But a watershed is generally all of the tributaries connected to to a river.
So back to the EL. I mean, what were you
I was just going
to
say that the Edible Manhattan did a article in one of their first magazines about watersheds and
That was written by Brian Howell.
Yeah, and how that it's kind of like terroir, how that affects the flavor and the things of animals and plants that are watered by these
and also
these
the
watersheds.
Pizza and the beers. Mm-hmm. You know, they say Brooklyn water has a certain thing to it. Yeah. I mean, it's a very it's subversive. It's so important. You know, it's so everywhere that
you don't even think about it.
But tell us about this. I mean, this eel is amazing, and I didn't know there was another ocean out there, a sea within the Atlantic. That's really cool. But what were some of the other ones?
We have oyster toadfish, which is...
Is that oyster or fish?
It's a fish. It's really common in the Hudson River. It looks like a toad, I guess, which...
It has, like, barnacles on it?
Barnacles don't actually grow on it, but... it does have a lot of fleshy lobes coming off of it, and it's I mean, some people say it's ugly, but it's almost
attractive.
So ugly it's cute. yeah. But and they're called oyster toadfish because
only a scientist.
I know. I was gonna say that.
They're called oyster toadfish because they typically live in oyster reef systems. So, not many people know this nowadays because it's not relevant in our day-to-day life like it used to be, but the Hudson River and the New York Harbor used to be covered with 350 square miles of oyster reefs. So that's a very, very productive system, and we used to be the largest exporter of oysters in the world.
Really?
Yeah, and we don't have many oysters left anymore, and we certainly don't have any reefs in the Hudson River or in the New York Harbor, really. But we're doing a lot to try to bring them back because it promotes biodiversity, having these crazy systems, and they filter the water. They do a lot of good things.
So what happened to the reef? It's gone?
We ate them.
Yeah, we...
and killed them.
We definitely...
Yeah,
we ate it all.
So let me ask this. From the culinary perspective, I mean, we have two great chefs here. Tell us, I mean, are any of these edible and are markets growing? Or, I mean, what from the edible food perspective, what do you have any fish that you've caught?
They're edible to, but it's recommended that you don't eat much of them per week or per month. Each sort of fish and species has its own guidelines. Oysters, no, not edible.
Not
from
here.
Out of New York Harbor. From Long Island Sound, yeah, there's still active fisheries, but... Other fish, depending on where they live and how far they swim and stuff.
But you can fish in the Hudson. Like, yeah, could a restaurant fish in the Hudson and serve that fish?
Not commercially.
Not recommended.
Yeah.
But is it illegal?
We could go and you could catch a striped bass and take it home and eat it. It's no problem. But you can't sell it. I couldn't catch it and sell it to a restaurant.
Is there a movement towards people who just fished in, like... I mean, if you fished in Maine, a chef would be like, yes, I want your fish. That's amazing. Or down in South Carolina. But what about New York State? I mean, are there any people selling Hudson River caught fish?
Well, I would assume there's some kind of, you know, stigma to it of, you know, no, you know, people are afraid to eat a lot of things from the Hudson River because of the pollution
And yet
level.
The fish might just pass through the polluted area, go to the Atlantic,
right.
And then
exactly.
It's okay.
That's a good point, yeah. So there's a lot of migratory patterns here, and they might pass through a polluted area or spend a certain amount of time in a heavily polluted area, but like striped bass, like we talked about, those are the most sought-after sport fish probably in the area, those with bluefish. But the striped bass will come in, spend not a huge amount of time in a polluted area like the Hudson River, but will spend a lot of time in the Atlantic. So they're generally thought of as being safe to eat, and they're still caught as a sport fish in this area quite a bit, but not like it used to be, of course.
You have, I just noticed here, you have Porgy on the, or Scup used to be the name of it.
Porgy is the best.
I have Porgy in my menu. Well, not on my menu. I do it as a special, and I don't get it from the Hudson, but I do get it from Long Island. And
yeah.
It's a really, really good fish.
Yeah.
I mean, but most people don't, they want to throw it out because they don't even know anything about it, but it's a great fish.
Yeah, they are great. Yeah, they're great fish. We see them fairly infrequently in at our pier, at Pier 40, but we do see them every year. But yeah, they're excellent for eating, that's for sure.
So, and then I want to ask, well, anyway, it's just very interesting. I mean, for do-it-yourselfers out there, who knows, maybe there's a striped bass business. We should probably, we have about 6 minutes left.
I have one more fish to ask about.
Okay, yeah.
Because this is kind of interesting. There's seahorse in the Hudson River. Wait, hold on.
Yeah, they're pretty cute.
Are they cute? Yeah. What, a lined seahorse. Where well, they? How many is there? Is there a lot? What's their purpose there?
This year we've been catching a decent amount, but they're around. They tend to be. We usually find them from April until November, in the warmer months, and there's quite a bit of them. There's even more. Their closest relative is a pipefish, which kind of looks like a long, stretched out version of a seahorse, and they're really abundant all over New York.
What do they eat, and what eats them?
They eat little shrimp. Fish will eat them. Other things eat them. They're not, you know, there's not a lot to them. They're mostly bony, so they're not. And they camouflage really well, so I think that's what sort of keeps them around.
Yeah, they're very slow moving, so they don't have good defense mechanisms. In that sense, they can't swim away from a predator, but so they have good camouflage, and they hang out and they hang onto sticks and onto plants and other material debris in the river. So there's actually quite a few of them. We've probably caught 40 or 45 of them this year. Which is quite a few for just a few months.
And they're going upriver from the ocean, or they're kind of just coming up for a little bit and then going back out?
They live, you know, mostly are marine species, the seahorse, but it's thought that they migrate in from the deeper waters in the winter, and then they like to be in the estuaries, and normally they're associated with vegetation, eelgrass, things like that. So we find them hanging on to things like rope or our crab pots or the traps that we have. They like to hang on to it as habitat. And
wow.
Just kind of...
Very cool.
Well, yep. We have Jack actually is working on getting us a new show from... we have this great show called Why We Cook, hosted by Erica Wides. And her father is an important guy at the Natural History Museum. All about like marine life and all these kind of New York State type of things. So fascinating, and hopefully you can be on his show. We need to take a break, and then we should come back, I think, for a short like 6 minute, because we have so much. We haven't talked about Kathy Drew, who I know is your founder, what people can do to help, and who are some of the other people in your program. So we'll take a 30-second break and come back for some information-packed finales. So we're here on a Sunday at beautiful Roberta's Restaurant at 261 Moore Street in Bushwick, Brooklyn.
The sky has cleared.
It is.
That storm is gone.
It wants... I know I shouldn't attribute human emotions to inanimate objects, but I was saying it wants to come out. The sun wants to come out.
It does want to come
out. It finally came. This is the main course, and we have very interesting, almost like natural history moment where we study. I love personalities of animals.
Uh-huh.
Like, why does the eel do that? Where does it go? You know, what's its destiny? So we have these great guys at JT Bame and Chris Anderson. And let's just ask some questions. First of all, who founded, I mean, Kathy Drew, I know, is the founder. Like, who is she? And tell me a little bit about the history of the River Project.
Yeah, Kathy Drew is our founder and our executive director. She started the River Project in 1986, and she's been working very hard since then to educate the public and really bring people close to the Hudson River Estuary and the New York Harbor, and just promoting overall conservation in general of aquatic ecosystems in the New York City area. But she's an excellent person, and she's a great character, and she's really exciting. If you ever get a chance to talk to her, I would recommend it. She's very fun. But yeah, she started this in 1986. We were at Pier 26 in Tribeca, and the structural
Pier 26.
Yeah,
huh?
Pier 26.
You have a base there.
We were there, and the pier actually started becoming structurally unsound and falling into the river. So they redid the whole Tribeca waterfront and ripped out our pier, and we're temporarily displaced at Pier 40. But Kathy was there for 20 years.
What a way to go, though, for the River Project. I mean, if you had to go somehow because the pier broke, you were doing your job so well.
We're grassroots.
And now, tell us, who is, just running a water preservation, species preservation research center is amazing. Tell us the various roles of the four or five people you have working there, also so that others can see, like, who you positioned where and what each one does.
Well, I'm the educator, so I do all the educational programs, and JT.
Yeah, I do aquatic. My title's aquatic projects manager, so I work on a lot of do a bunch of different things, but sort of help with the wet lab and also set up and oversee different research projects that we work on. We've got a couple of our coworkers, Nina Zane and Nikki Sahadi. We all sort of have. We're all sort of jack of all trades when it comes to things that we do at the River Project, but we do a lot of, you know, a lot of research, education. We try and facilitate researchers if we can who want to do work on the Hudson and bring as many people to the waters possible.
So I guess a question I would pose to both of you are what has been the River Project's greatest success to date? And what legacy would you like to leave with it? Like, is there some project looming on the horizon that you would like to see, you know, fulfilled or accomplished?
Well, Kathy really had a big role in making the Hudson River estuary an estuary of national significance, and that was in the mid to late 80s. And that has really brought a lot of attention and to the estuary, the specific area, like we talked about with the salt and the tidal influence. So that's I would say that's huge. So that's brought a lot of attention to the area and it's given us the opportunity to actually conserve it and do what we want and actually take action in really protecting the area. So that's huge.
Yeah, and another thing, one thing that we had at Pier 26, which we don't have now, but we hope to get back, is an estuarium. So we have a couple thousand gallons of tanks set up for our wet lab that we do research with. But at the old pier, we had also a system that would, you know, basically a public aquarium for people to come in and see the different animals and species that live in the river. And we hope that we can go back to Pier 26 at some point in the future and build and set up a new estuarium, which, you know, free for the public. So to
be real museum of sorts.
Yeah, a little bit mostly live organisms. So it's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. And I guess I have one more question. Then, John, if you want to close out, if you have a question. I mean, I want to know, like, what our listeners can do to help. Is there... You guys are a 501c3, correct? So yep. How do people learn more about your...
What's 501?
Nonprofit. Tax deduction.
Yeah. Yeah, we are a nonprofit. Well, people can always go to theriverproject.org.
Okay.
And they'll be able to see what we're up to. And it's a really cool site with a lot of interesting links and a lot of interesting things to look at. And we have fish sounds, and we have a lot of basically all our current projects and our plans for the future and our accomplishments in the past. Mm-hmm. And I guess the one thing that I would say the two things, I guess, first of all, get to the water, get to the Hudson River, learn about it, understand that it's very important and it's very user-friendly. There's a lot of recreation opportunities, and this is these are things that not everybody in New York knows about. And not a lot of people, I mean, half the people who come to our pier or come to the river are actually almost scared of the water because they've grown up in New York City, and you don't think about it on a day-to-day basis, and you think it's kind of a scary, polluted place where, if I fall in, I'm dead. But things have changed so much now. You can kayak, and you can go on boat rides, and I definitely encourage people
triathlons.
You can swim
in it.
Sign up for that.
Like she was on the on pace for the gold medal until she died from pollution in the Hudson. No, that's not the case.
No, that's not the attitude to have.
Sorry. Well, you guys have been amazing, and you know, when we're on this, when we're on Heritage Radio, we strive to
talk about food.
We strive to talk
about food. We talk about food.
What are you doing?
Jeez. Nice on the sound effects. I think it's just playing over and over. Anyway, you guys have been awesome. Very interesting. I hope you guys come back on the show or on other shows on the network. And I guess we wish you the best of luck with your amazing work.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for coming in.
We'll be right back in 30 seconds with Jacques Gauthier from Palo Santo. Sunday, it's Meet the Course. I'm Patrick Martins.
And I'm Shauna Pacifico.
We have a sponsorship thanks to Saxo Beach Cheesemongers in the Essex Street Market, all east of the Mississippi cheeses. It's amazing. Best you'll ever find. And our second and final guest of the show is a very big supporter of all things sustainable, Jacques Gauthier from Palo Santo. Welcome, Jacques.
Thank you.
So tell us, I'm going to start it off.
Go ahead.
Why don't we go 1-1-1-1, because I have like a bunch of questions I want to ask.
Yeah.
Tell us how you came to, tell us about the history of Palo Santo. It's such an interesting restaurant, the way it's placed right there on Union Street, correct?
On Union between 4th and 5th.
So how did you find that place? It seems like it's just a regular apartment that you made a restaurant out of, and tell a little bit about the cuisine that you do there as well.
The building has an interesting history. Actually, about 100 years ago, it was turned into a ravioli shop. It was later a candy store, and then it was some type of, not quite a church, but maybe a religious social club type of place. Hmm. But it was always, for at least over 100 years, it was commercial, and so it's grandfathered in as a commercial space. But it's in the middle of a residential block. I think it's kind of interesting. It's not a ruckus type place, so my neighbors don't get too upset, and I think that people like the idea of finding this kind of, hidden little place in the middle of a residential block.
They just get upset with what you do in your apartment upstairs. You know,
that's the thing. I make more noise than the customers. People worry about...
It's a big building, small building?
It's a small place, about 3 floors, you know.
Uh-huh. And you live right upstairs. That's got to be...
Yeah, I live upstairs.
So. You sound excited, but not excited by that?
Oh, no, I like living upstairs. I just don't always like everyone to know I live upstairs.
Does the staff like knock on your door and be like, he's not... bussing his station correctly.
Occasionally, I had to actually rubber coat my door knocker because of the beer guys coming to deliver beer early in the morning.
Oh, God. You used to not like getting early deliveries from La Frida. They're like, we know he's right up there. Why doesn't he come down?
So you buy some stuff from Heritage. Where else do you source some of your products from?
Well, interesting. You were talking about fish that... either were caught in the Hudson or might have been in the Hudson. We occasionally, not every week, but, you know, occasionally we'll get fish from a Blue Moon Fish that's there at the farmer's market at Grand Army Plaza on Saturdays. And they get fish from Long Island Sound from other local waters. And
What's a Blue really Moon Fish? Stuff.
Yeah, Blue Moon Fish.
They're in Union Square on Wednesdays.
How is it different to source fish than it is meats, than it is like fruits and vegetables? Is it all the same thing, just personal relationship, or does each food have its own kind of orbit and culture to sourcing?
Well, you know, there are the really standard distribution, you know, standard systems for distribution of foods. And then, you know, there's some people who kind of think outside of the box a little bit. You know, some restaurants will go to one huge company that will provide them with everything from, you know, toilet paper and napkins to fish and strawberries. And then, you know, there are other, you know, alternative forms of distribution. The green market is actually now becoming a major, I'd say it's really becoming a major form of distribution. I see it becoming more and more and more popular. And a lot of the farms are more and more willing to work with the restaurants, even like, you know, Red Jacket Orchard, that we get our stone fruit and apples and stuff from. They're getting larger, and they're sold, you know, at a few large grocery stores. But they will stop by the restaurant every Friday to drop off 2 or 3 cases of apples or raspberries, something like that. You know, so if you want the short answer is if you want more interesting products, you've got to really look hard to source them.
Jacques is a great, within the Heritage Network, you know, our toughest thing of launching a wholesale pork business was what to do with the cuts you couldn't sell. So he was one of the first chefs in the country to volunteer to be like, call me when you have the random stuff left. You know, I can figure out a way to make it work.
That's good. That's a good way to, you know, you got to eat the whole thing. Can't just eat the best parts.
And what are you trying to do with these foods? I mean, what is your take on food? I mean, what argument are you making in your kitchen?
What argument am I making in my kitchen?
I mean, in a positive way. You know what I mean? What's your thing?
I think that there are a number of things that I'm trying to say, you know, by running Palo Santo the way I run it, more so than just, you know, here's food, you know, eat it, pay me, go. I think that it's kind of a difficult medium, really, because, you know, you don't want to alienate anybody. So you don't want to preach too much. You don't want to tell people too much. You don't want to hit them over the head with it. You know, there's certain things that we do that are subtle and some that are not so subtle. Like, you know, for example, that we get whole pigs in from Heritage and we butcher them right in front of the customers in the open kitchen. So somebody, you know, if somebody's at the bar doing the tasting menu at the kitchen counter, they're literally, you know, 6 inches from the head of a 100-pound pig. Mm-hmm. And one thing we want to say is that, you know, look, this is your food. Know where your food came from. Have respect for it. And in turn, the people who provide you with it will respect it more.
I totally agree. I think that's becoming more and more important for people to understand where their food comes from and not realize that everything's pretty and packaged in plastic, you know, at grocery stores. Mm-hmm. How long has Palo Santo been open?
We just had our third anniversary, so it's been a little over 3 years.
What's your background? Where'd you start off before that?
For the past 12 years or so, I've worked in a number of different restaurants, picking up, you know,
Vong? Did you work at Vong?
I worked at Vong for a little while, yeah. About a year I worked there. I worked for 3.5 years before I opened my own place at this small pizza place in Williamsburg called the Brick Oven Gallery. I've worked a number of different places. I worked for
San Francisco?
I worked at a Z in San Francisco. I spent about a year out there just to, you know, check it out, see what was going on out there. You know, I never really went to any, you know, school like the CIA or anything like that. I took some classes, mostly nutrition classes at the Natural Gourmet, but I really feel that cooking is something you've got to learn in experiencing and doing.
Yeah,
absolutely. And I mean, what's the word in front of Palo Santo? It's comandir or
comedor. You know, I never liked calling the place a restaurant. I always called it a comedor, which in Spanish that means dining room. Comedor popular is the word for communal dining hall, and in almost every single Latin American city, or you know, in small towns, there is a central market, and right next door to the central market is a comedor popular where you can go and eat foods that were prepared from that market. Comedor also could be an informal kind of like a supper club or something like that. And, you know, we're fully licensed, of course, but, you know, we try to keep that feel of the idea of going and eating in somebody's home, in somebody's dining room, not so much going out to a restaurant.
Where are you from?
I'm from D.C. My father's from Haiti. My mom's from Delaware. I've got a lot of family in Puerto Rico and Dominican Republic and other places. And, you know, kind of spread out a mix, a little bit of this and a little bit of that.
Where aren't you from?
Yeah.
That'd be quicker. That's pretty intense. Would you say that your cuisine follows a certain style of Spanish or Puerto Rican or Cuban? I mean, is there a... Mm-hmm.
It's as far as a specific nationality to our dishes, you know, just like, you know, you asked me my background, and I think that I'm, you know, a pretty mixed person, and I think my style is pretty mixed. And I think that anybody who looks at their own, you know, heritage is going to see that they're also mixed. And that's something that I think, you know, is really beautiful about humanity and that we, you know, try to express in our cuisine. So we don't stick to one specific, you know, regional cuisine. We use a lot of local ingredients from New York State. So, you know, is it not, is
Italian,
the food not New York
then,
cuisine?
Yeah, New York or Italian, I mean, that's what they do. But is there certain ingredients you tend towards more, even if they're available year round, or like you're really waiting for that season to come because it's a certain food that you grew up tasting? Tomatoes, potatoes, eggs.
Yeah, I would say right now is a great season. It's the end of the summer. One thing that I really like to do is to source products directly from the farm, and specifically from Latin American growers who are, you know, here in New Jersey or in New York. For example, the Teo's egg farm in Red Hook, New York, we get eggs from them all year round. But now they also have a number of different vegetables and Nestor plants, you know, odd species of potatoes and chilies and corn and, you know, different kind of quirky little vegetables that he just plants a few of. You know, I don't even know what he's going to bring by sometimes. And sometimes he introduces me to new things. There was one time he brought by, it's kind of like cucumber, but it's hollow. And it's called caigua or pepino de rellenar. And, you know, for stuffing, he had brought the seeds back from Colombia and he was able to grow vines in his greenhouse.
That's happening more and more. I find that these immigrants are starting farms that are growing things that aren't common around here and are very different. I also really love this season now because peppers and the end of summer is just where everything is. There's, I mean, you go to the market, it's like a big playground. But the peppers are coming in, and the aji dulces are, those peppers are really, really good.
Fantastic. And have you thought of a second restaurant, Jack? You know, I mean, do you crave or do you like the idea of that one place and the relationships you've built there?
You know, it's a funny thing. I haven't yet really had the opportunity to open a new place, you know, and you know, with the economy the way it is, it's, you know, kind of better to be a little more cautious, I think. But a new place would be really hard for me to run because I'm at Palo Santo
all the time,
you know, and it would be, I don't know, I used to think about that, but then 3 years into it, I'm very happy at Palo Santo, you know, I make an honest living for myself there, and I do, you know, do what I want to do what I always wanted to be doing. And so, you know, there's not really a need for me to open a second place now.
How big is your staff, your kitchen staff?
My kitchen staff, there's two dishwashers and two cooks, and then myself, you know, so that's it's pretty small. We have two interns now also.
Do you do lunch or you do dinner or you do lunch and dinner?
Dinner 7 nights a week and brunch on the weekends.
Yeah.
Fantastic. I actually have a personal question. I want to ask about your Pan-American Highway trip that you took. I mean, did you go from Chile to Mexico?
Before opening up Palo Santo, I took an eight-month trip where I studied the cuisine of a number of different countries in Latin America, and I flew to Argentina and I worked for a couple months at a winery in Argentina, and then made my way up mostly by bus or by boat some of the way hitchhiking, some of the way, getting a ride on a boat, some of the way, you know, on trains and public transportation, all the way up to Mexico City, where I spent 2 months, and then
I'm jealous.
Wow, what?
Came home with a whole book of recipes. Jealous.
Is that a tough trip? Is it dangerous? Would you recommend it for everyone? Or the South Americans seem very nice. Did they make it easy for you?
I'd recommend, you know, definitely traveling to everyone. I think that as far as that specific trip is right for everybody, I don't know. It's a long time to be traveling.
8 months is a very long time.
What cultures, cuisines, did one in particular, a style or a place, or is it similar between the various countries there?
I'd say the two places in Latin America that have the most interesting cuisines would be Central Mexico and Peru and Bolivia also. I think I would attribute that to the existence of a pre-Columbian civilization that was very far advanced. The Incas, the Mayans, the Aztecs, you know, they all had very far advanced cuisines. And when that mixed with the Spanish and the African and whatever else, in Southeast Asian, and it really made an interesting cuisine that is preserved today.
That's amazing. Central Mexico, is that Chiapas?
Mexico City, Puebla, okay. Oaxaca, Chiapas also. Really interesting foods, and in Peru also. I think that those two places were the two real centers of pre-Columbian, high pre-Columbian civilization.
Uh-huh. Will you be on next week and tell us about your catering gig to Marcos, the head of the Zapatista revolutionaries in Mexico? Did you ever work with him? Anyway, this has been very, very interesting. Jacques, it's Palo Santo. Is there a website people can go to?
Yeah, palosanto.us.
P-A-O-L-O.
PaloSanto.us, PaloSanto.us.
.us. It's a very delicious restaurant, and it's so beautiful, especially that back area with the fountain. You kind of feel like you're not in New York.
It's a close bike ride for me, so I should head over there soon.
And to be fair, Back 40 is very good. Shauna is the amazing co-host. No one would co-host with me. We asked thousands of people until you finally said yes.
I was your last choice.
No, you were the first. I'm kidding. I wouldn't admit that on air. So hopefully you'll be back, Shauna. You've been an amazing co-host.
Thanks.
And on the main course.
Is this my last week?
Next week you're going.
Next week I'm going. So, we're going on a field trip.
Where are you going next week?
We're doing a staff party, and we're going, getting a bus and going down to Maxwell Farms in New Jersey, and we're going to cook out whole lamb and drink beer and wine and lay in the grass.
You're the Max, Shauna.
And play softball or Kickball.
Kickball. You know what's fun? These guys at Roberta's, they put three of those slip and slides together.
Slip and slide.
You can
slide.
Get like 40, 50 miles an
hour.
That's
a good one.
Three together, though. That's the key. So this has been great. We talked about the River Project. We talked about Palo Santo. And next week, we'll talk about more food-related causes and
that's
themes.
That's what the show's
the
about, right?
All right.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be back next week. Stay tuned for the Q Report coming up next.